the line. This is the commentary.ca. David Berner has long been a broadcasting personality in these parts. His late-night programs on CKNW and CJOR are remembered for their eclectic mix of conversation and discussion, debate and entertainment on the widest possible spectrum of subjects. He's also a sought-after lecturer and speaker, actor, writer, and addictions expert. He is community liaison at Langara College. His website, davidberner.com, is the home to his excellent blog, The Berner Monologues. I am very pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program David Berner. Good morning, Mr. Berner.
Hi, Joseph. How are you?
Thanks for joining us. I'm pretty good. What is this job at Langara that you do? You're community liaison. Is that similar to what Stephen Owen is doing at UBC?
I don't know what Stephen's doing at UBC, so I can't say. What I'm doing is trying to maintain and build on Langara's presence in the community. Langara is kind of a beautifully well-kept secret. It's a tremendous college with great faculty, smart, dedicated people. People who are fun. It's a you know, for a college, it's a fairly big campus. We just opened a new $50 million state-of-the-art ultra-green, ultra-ecologically sound library. And, you know, the college does great work, and it still attracts lots and lots of students there. You know, 8,000 regular students, 1,500 international students, 20,000 continuing studies students. So it still gets its fair share of students, but it's just kind of a quiet place. It just, you know, it doesn't have the budget and the money that, the big universities have and that BCIT has. So without spending a lot of money and doing a lot of advertising, my job is to do what I can to put it out into the community. So, for example, tomorrow, a couple of our professors will be on Fannie Kiefer's Studio 4 talking of all things Scientology. But it was great that they came to us and asked, did we have, you know, a person or two to cover that. And then I've created a public debate series at the library downtown called the Langara Dialogues. Just as an example, the one coming up in February is Resolved Prisons Work, and we'll have a wonderful Justice Wally Craig debating against Tom Sanborn, who's a well-known writer in town, but among other things, he's on the board of the BC Civil Liberties Association. In March, we will have one that I hope will get you there for, Joseph, because the resolution is Resolved Canadian Newspapers Are Yesterday's News. And we'll have Kirk Lapointe, the managing editor of the Vancouver Sun, debating against David Beers, editor of thetie.ca. So that's the kind of thing I'm doing. I also created a whole new volunteerism at the college called Langara Cares. We're putting more and more kids out into the community doing volunteer work. So that's my work.
You know, I spent 2 years at Langara.
Oh.
After high school. And went on to UBC after that. And I must say, one of my fondest memories of the place, and I agree with you, it's a great place to go to school.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, my fondest memory were the hamburgers at in the Student Union building.
Well, I confess that even at my old age, I completely blew all rationality and had a small box of fries today.
It's a great place, I must say.
The fries were great.
Yeah, it is a really neat place. Did you miss broadcasting at all?
I don't miss it a lot. I had an odd relationship with broadcasting. I always loved the microphone and the camera, and I felt that I was lucky that they liked me back generally. But I always really hated management. Wherever, it just didn't matter where I was, at any broadcast outlet, at radio stations, at television stations, particularly in radio, but also television, I found management to be, in general, disingenuous would be a kind word. They were mostly dishonest, and you never knew what they were talking about. They were always saying, you'd have a meeting, and they'd talk about red for an hour, and then they'd send you an email and say, gee, it was great to spend an hour talking about blue. And you'd always walk out going, what? Didn't we just talk about red for an hour? So I always loved the work, and I always felt not comfortable with the environment. So quite frankly, after all those years, I mean, I've been a broadcaster off and on for close to 30 years, I'm quite happy to not do it.
A lot of, I mentioned to a friend of mine who, that you were coming on to talk to me about, you know, just to come on the program, and he says, oh yeah, David Berner, a little Berner in the night.
That's right.
And had you always broadcast late night or in the evenings?
No, in fact, that program, which was the first commercial, the first broadcasting I ever did, actually, was for CBC, and I did all kinds of things for them. I was a TV interviewer, writer, producer on the news here and in Edmonton, and I was the first guy to host a television program for Access Alberta, and I did, and that was a morning show, and I did the morning show in Ottawa at CJOH, which is the CTV affiliates. But when I presented this idea to the guy who was then general manager at CJOR, I presented it as a drive-home show, because I always wanted to do the drive-home show. And he bought it, but he had a program director who my former wife used to call Dr. Death, because he was such a deadly character. He was just no smiles, no... in psychology, you would say he had no affect. He just sort of stared at you. And he said, well, it's not a drive show. It's a late-night show. So the boss put me on late at night, so I was on from 10 at night to 1 in the morning. And then, you know, many years later, a lot of years later, that was 83, and then 10 years later, in fact, CKNW said, we want to do overnight live radio, so come and do late night. And so I was on from midnight till 4, which was quite crazy, because I was already almost 50 years old.
You know, I met you once. You'd took a friend to pick up their car at the impound lot.
Oh.
And I was working there at the time.
Oh, behind, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and I saw you, and then I pointed at you, and I said very loudly so that everyone could hear that you're the reason why I'm an insomniac. Because I'd listened to that midnight to 4 a.m. show for forever.
That's funny. I remember that incident. And I remember coming at the foot of Howe Street under the bridge.
Right.
And I remember coming. Now, whose car was it? I can't remember. But I do remember that you, I didn't associate it with you, but I remember somebody, but now you tell me it's you, saying, hey, I know you.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Great.
So doing that show, I mean, that was, that, even though the hours sort of sucked, that must have been fun.
Which one are we talking about, the late night?
Yeah, the midnight, yeah, the NW show.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It was a different kind of broadcasting, and I liked it. I mean, the hours, you just had to live that way. You just sort of reset your clock, which was kind of difficult because your body would tend to want to wake up at 8 in the morning, and people would be running power mowers and things, you know, at 9 o'clock. But you just tried to shift the way you live, but yeah, absolutely, it was fun. You had a different kind of audience. You had cops and hookers and junkies and nurses and guys who ran all-night gas stations, and you know, that kind of, and just insomniacs. I mean, people who just didn't sleep very well. For example, I have a fabulous oil painting in the hallway of my house, and the hallway is sort of almost two stories high, so this painting fills up the whole length of that wall, and it's of Douglas firs, it's of trees in like Stanley Park or somewhere, and the guy who did that was a retired lawyer who had suffered a personal tragedy in his family, and he just didn't sleep very well, and so he had reverted to what he always wanted to do, which was oil painting. And he was up all night painting. And eventually, you know, I met him and I bought that painting from him. But that's the kind of person who was up at that hour.
And the level of discussion, I mean, it was not as serious as, say, the morning guys like Rafe Mayer. But it in some instances it was, that you were able to talk about serious subjects and have a very high level of caller, did you not?
Absolutely. We had some wonderful callers. And one of the things I've always said about talk radio, whether whether it was on at 2 in the morning or when I shifted down the clock to between 7 and 10, which in a way was the best hours for me. But regardless of the hours, one of the things I always thought about talk radio is that it was so amazing, Joe, that whatever you talked about, if you talked about a murder, the murderer would phone. You know, whatever you talked about, there was someone out there who actually knew the exact story. I mean, for example, the Air India disaster. So at one point I remember talking about this, and a caller, you know, I mean, you don't know who the callers are. They tell the guy who answers the phone, you know, my name's Bill, and I'm calling from Burnaby, you know, so all you get is, let's go to Burnaby, hello, Bill. I remember this gal was a stewardess, and she was at Narita Airport in Tokyo and just barely missed being killed by that bomb that killed two baggage handlers. And she was right there. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing that was always amazing about talk radio. But, yes, we talk about public policy issues. I think the kinds of things we talked about that were much more serious were those kinds of human dilemmas, you know, issues of interaction and relationships and addictions, and those kinds of struggles that people have.
Talk to me about what you think the state of talk radio is today. I mean, I miss your show. I miss Rafe Mayer. I miss Jack Cullen even.
Absolutely. I think it's bankrupt, basically. I don't think there's much going on. You know, there's this guy out of Winnipeg who was, in my opinion, he was a second or fourth level kind of broadcaster. He was kind of a fake. He was sort of a construct. I mean, the secret of talk radio is just be yourself. Just get out there and be who you are. But this guy that they put on across the country, I forget his name even, doesn't matter. But anyways, I think he's still on the radio. But he was sort of a construct. He was sort of a guy who made up this persona of being a tough guy, and he had a tough sort of sound. It was all a bunch of BS. Here in town, who does what could pass for talk radio? Bill Good? I mean, Bill Good is a very pleasant newsreader, and you know, he's a nice fellow, but he's a newsreader. He wouldn't know talk radio if he fell in a vat of it, you know. He doesn't have an opinion about anything. He doesn't do anything except broadcast. He broadcasts in the morning. He broadcasts at night. I don't know what kind of a life he has other than broadcasting and making money. And so I know how he works personally. He doesn't look up from his notes. Everything is pre-scripted. He doesn't listen to people that he's talking to. And in fact, he doesn't look at them. He doesn't look at his guests. I don't know how you can discuss something with someone without looking at them. So who is there? Christy Clark? I mean, Christy's a lightweight. There aren't a lot of people who are prepared to really wrestle with ideas and you know, I mean, I don't want to go, you know, name by name listing people, but there just isn't a lot. I don't think there's, I mean, you tell me, I don't think there's a lot of excitement in talk radio these days. In America, there's lots of talk radio. I mean, there's a convention every year somewhere, Las Vegas or somewhere, of talk radio practitioners, and they get, you know, 5,000 people.
Radio Row.
There's a lot of people doing it. The only guy that I listen to consistently, could you possibly guess who it is?
Rush Limbaugh.
Sorry?
Rush Limbaugh.
No, I hate Rush Limbaugh. I think Rush Limbaugh is detestable. No, I listen to Jim Rome on the team.
Right.
When I'm driving to work in the morning, because he's talking about sports, and he has the audacity to be funny. And, I mean, one of the things that's missing from so much of what is passing for radio these days is a sense of humor. You don't have it. I mean, people don't realize it. Yes, you can talk about the death sentence. You can talk about taxes. You can talk about cancer. You can talk about any kind of issue, and you can treat it with great respect. But if you don't also leaven it somehow with some humor, you're lost. I don't understand how you can do these things without finding the humor in them, because, frankly, it's my best survival technique.
You said that to be a good talk show host, you had to be yourself. But is there a lot of preparation that goes into being yourself, do you think?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think you have to have a sense of who you are, or what your strengths are. One of the ironies of being a talk radio host is the biggest skill isn't talking. The biggest skill is listening, and that's true of any conversation. I mean, lots of people, Joe, are born with the gift of the gab. The question then is, what do you do with it? What do you do with the gift of the gab? As a guy out of Bellingham or somewhere just across the border who sells cars, and he looks and sounds like a televangelist, and he's so reminiscent of guys. Remember there was a guy named Ralph Williams or something like that 20, 30 years ago on TV selling cars out of the States? And that's what this guy is like. This guy is so smooth, he's so oily, so unctuous. He really has the gift of the gab, but so did Jimmy Swaggart, you know, so did lots of guys. But they're, you know, what do you do with it? If what you do with it is sell, you know, used cars or sell simplistic versions of spirituality or religion, then who needs you? You know, so if lots of us can talk, the issue is then what do you do with it? I think you have to know what you're good at, what you're capable of. You know, there's a wonderful guy who used to be around here, and he got better and better as the years went on. But when he started out, somebody asked me, "What's the matter with that guy?" And I said, "He doesn't understand the power of the microphone. He tries too hard. He keeps trying to sell his ideas. And you don't have to work so hard to sell your ideas. If you really understand what the idea is and you believe in it, then you just have to say it, you know? And you say it because you mean it, and you mean it because you say it."
You used to have a phrase about conducting conversations around a kitchen table.
Yeah.
And that's the sense that I really got about your program and what I liked about it, that no matter how serious the subject was, it felt comfortable. Where did you learn that skill?
I learned it at exactly where I am at this minute, Joe, at the kitchen table. I learned it literally at the kitchen table. Look, I grew up in the north end of Winnipeg in an immigrant Russian Jewish family, and I lived in my grandparents' home. And although it was a big house with lots of rooms, and we filled them, you know, we were all over the house, the real center of the house, of course, was the kitchen. And although we had a big dining room table, we only used the dining room table for high holidays, for, you know, like Passover and so on. Most meals, 95% or more of all the meals, happen around the kitchen table. And everybody would sit down to dinner every night of the week and eat and talk about all the horrible and funny things that happened all day long and tell stories. And I was a little kid. I was like 5, 6 years old, and I sat there with my head on, you know, my chin and my hands, with my head tilting back and forth, looking at the grown-ups telling stories. And I've essentially never left that kitchen table. I'm sitting at my own kitchen table right now because I know I'm going to have a conversation with you. And to me, that's where conversations take place. They take place in a place of comfort, which of course is associated with food. So that's literally what I meant by it. And I'm still there. I haven't left. I'm sitting at my own table.
On your website is a list of some of the famous and infamous people that you've interviewed over the years. Do you have tapes of your old interviews?
It's amazing you should ask me that, because my cousin Perry emailed me the other day, and he said, "Where's the tapes on your website of when you used to talk to my mother? My Aunt Toby used to phone me from Winnipeg." And do you remember any of these? My Aunt Toby used to phone, and we'd talk. He said he was a doctor, and he was on an Indian reservation in northern Manitoba, and he said he had this shortwave radio, and he'd pick up the program, and he'd hear his mother, my Aunt Toby, and me talking as if we were the only two people in the room. She would phone me from Winnipeg.
Right.
And we talk like we're sitting at the kitchen table. I don't think I have those tapes, and I don't know if I have You know, I may have some of them, but, you know, I'm at that stage in life where I have a garage full of boxes of things, like photos, audio tapes, in various formats, you know, reel-to-reel, now little discs, even 8-tracks, and I've got videotapes, VHS tapes, and more industrial kind of tapes. Now I have DVDs of work that I've done, and I don't know if I'll ever get around to looking at it all and figuring out what it all is. And, you know, because somebody has said, you should put some of those shows on the website, you know, so that you have more audio tracks. And I don't know. If I find the time, Joe, I'll do some of it.
One of the interesting things about the blog is you talk about municipal affairs, current affairs. I read somewhere on the internet, one of these message boards or something, your name had come up in terms of running for office at the next municipal election.
Yeah.
Is that something you've thought about?
Yeah, I have thought about it, and at this point I've completely rejected it. I'll tell you why. First of all, I thought about it in 2005, and I took a serious look at it. I talked to a number of people in office. Some people encouraged me, others told me, forget it, don't be crazy. And then I actually considered running for mayor. I mean, people were saying, and one of my friends in particular, I don't want to name him, but he is a very serious political operative. He helped two prime ministers get elected. He has the ear of people in high office. He's been around Ottawa. He's been around Victoria. He knows the territory. He knows how this is done. And he wanted me to run for mayor. And he said, I think you can win. Now, what happened was that in June, just bear with me, yeah, in June of 2005, I had a what is now laughingly called a minor heart operation, an angioplasty. And so as we approached the end of the summer, my friend, the political operative, said, okay, David, you have to make a decision. I said, okay, so if I say yes, what do we do? And he said, well, starting in about 3 weeks, you're going to have to make about 5 speeches a day. And I said, you know what? I don't have the physical strength to do that right now because I had this operation in June. And I'm just getting back in shape, and I just don't have the energy to do that. So we forgot about it. In the meantime, you know, 3 years, 3 years have gone by, and I've been tempted, and people talk to me about it. And, you know, it's a big vanity thing. It's a big ego trip. I used to make a joke on the radio all the time that, you know, if I'm mayor, I'm only doing it for the money. I expect, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash and paper bags in hotel rooms late at night. I expect a limo and a driver, and I expect everyone to call me sir. had free trips everywhere. But over the last couple of years, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, what the hell do I want to do that for? I mean, can you imagine sitting in those excruciatingly boring council meetings arguing about the minutiae of whether or not somebody should be allowed to build a porch or whatever on the back of their house? And then finally, I had this extraordinary good turn of fortune out of nowhere. The editor of the editorial page of the province sent me an email about 6 weeks ago, absolutely out of the blue, and asked me if I would write a column. So now that I'm writing this column on the editorial page, I would much rather write a column making fun of city politics than be in city politics.
And the column runs Sundays, does it?
No, it runs Fridays.
Fridays.
It happened to run on one Sunday. See, now I have another reason to hate Brian Mulroney, or Ryan Baloney. I always said Ryan Baloney was the worst prime minister in Canadian history. But then he went and did his confessional thing in Ottawa four weeks ago. And so they had to cover that with a Don Martin column out of Ottawa. So my column got bumped the second week it was up. It got bumped to a Sunday. But it's always on Fridays.
But you talked about making fun of the people at Cambie and 12th. You're not happy with the current group of politicians there of any party, really, are you?
Not really. I think, and I said this in the very first column that I wrote, and I meant it, although I was also, you know, having some fun and being satirical, but I meant it. I think it is truly the weakest and the worst city government we have ever had. And I talked about this in the column, that when you look back at the likes of Walter Hardwick or Jonathan Baker or even George Pule, who I didn't like, but he was a great alderman, of course, Harry Rankin, people of this quality, these guys knew the mechanics inside and out. They knew the bylaws. They knew how things worked. They knew where the skeletons were buried. They knew which guy drove which truck. They knew how to get something done. I don't think the current crop, in general, have a clue. They seem rudderless. They seem without an anchor. And let me examine that specifically. The MPA is rudderless because their so-called leader is an egotistical guy. I mean, he's just totally caught up. I'm talking about the mayor. He's just totally caught up with himself, as he always has been. He's a remarkably selfish and self-involved personality. And he has no interest in the party. He has no interest in, really, in city government. He's got an interest in his particular shticks, whatever they may be. And he's hunkered in this little corner with his advisors. He's hired all this staff with private money. And they're sort of doing their own thing, quite independent of the rest of the NPA and quite independent of City Hall. Then you look at Vision and Cope and that terrible split that they've got going on. And who is really leading them? Now, tomorrow, oddly enough, I'm going to go and have lunch with Raymond Louie, because I've always thought certain things about him, but I've never met him. What I've thought is that he's a very hardworking, very sincere and solid guy, but a little dull. I mean, can he summons, you know, the spark of personality to win an election? I don't know the answer. Maybe he can and maybe he can't. You know, the rumors on the street these days are that, in fact, I talked to somebody from Vision only yesterday who said to me, well, you know, the thinking is that maybe, you know, Gregor Robertson could win for us this time and Raymond could get a bit more seasoning and we'd put him up next time. I don't know about any of that, you know. I think a much bigger question I will ask Raymond point blank tomorrow when I see him, I'm looking forward to meeting him, he seems like a very decent guy, is can a Chinese counselor be elected mayor simply because he's Chinese? We have almost 50% Chinese population in Vancouver itself, in the city of Vancouver. So would the Chinese come out and vote for a guy just because he's Chinese? Certainly, there's no question that a Chinese mayor is inevitable in this city, sooner or later. And one friend predicted to me that within 10 years, the entire council will be Chinese, which may or may not be true. I have no idea. I don't like to see that kind of ethnic politics and ethnic voting, but it's a reality.
He doesn't speak Chinese, does he?
Sorry?
Does he speak Chinese?
I believe that Raymond does not, which is funny because Sullivan speaks Cantonese fluently.
Yeah, that's what I thought, yeah.
And Italian badly.
Carol Taylor, would she have been the answer in your mind?
This is what I think. I think several different things about Carol Taylor. I think Carol Taylor would have won easily. I think she could have been the mayor just by putting her name on the ballot. And I think she would have been a perfectly reasonable, a good mayor. She would do one of the jobs of the mayor admirably, which is be an ambassador to all and sundry. She's still a beautiful-looking woman, and she's charming and well-spoken, and she would represent us well on the local, national, international stages, and so on. She'd do all that fine. She'd be a good manager. She would manage the governance. It's not unlike Sullivan's ideas. It's not the job, and Kim Capripants, it's not their job to micromanage departments, and Carol knows that. So she would stick to governance, and she'd do a quietly reasonable job. I don't think she would ever allow a garbage strike to go on for 3 months like that. You know, I don't think she would get into fighting metal with people. I think she'd find better solutions. I don't think that she's a particularly enlightened person in terms of social policy, even though social policy is what interests me more than anything in politics, that might be a small issue, because she might not have to. So I think she would have been fine. I think she could have won. But I understand perfectly her many reasons for not doing it. I think the biggest single reason is it would be a come down. It would be, you know, years ago I played in shows of Theater Under the Stars. And then after many, many years, I didn't. And then I went back because I wanted to do a particular show. And my son said to me, you know, Dad, you can't do that because you did that 20 years ago and you can't go back. And he had the same experience being an athlete, being a football player. He had played for a little local team, and then he went and was given a scholarship at a school in California, and he played for that school and so on. When he came back, just because he wanted to stay in the game, he went back to that team. And I said, Sean, you can't do that. You can't go backwards. And he said, well, I'll try it for a while. He lasted 2 weeks, and he said, you know, you're right. It's just not interesting enough.
You know, there's so much to talk to you about with David, and we must have you on again. But I do want to thank you for coming on today. And we will read the blog with great interest over the next months and weeks ahead.
My pleasure. Thank you, Joe.
The book, The Purpose.